Are you an innovation champion? Kurt Carlson demonstrates how to become one.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are champions for customers, improving their lives with preferred products and services, value, and innovation. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hey, Hunter Hastings here. If you are a listener to our podcast intro today, you might notice that we slightly adjusted our language to refer to economic champions rather than economic heroes. Let me explain. Language is important, especially in business. Language brings light and artistry to the story of your business, the story you tell to your team about who you are, who they can be, your shared mission, and your shared norms. Companies are narratives. The language should be both inspirational and unifying. Everybody should feel like they're charging together towards the same goal and that they all have their valued role. So Kurt Carlson listened to our podcast intro and suggested this. Heroes are wonderful. They fight noble fights, often against the odds, and bring about a delightful and desired result. But can everyone be a hero? And if you are a hero, what does that leave for me? Is heroism elitist or divisive or demeaning to those who don't see themselves in that role? What you want everyone on your team to be, says Kurt, is a champion. It's a behavioral style. Everyone can be a champion, both in their own specialty and in the shared activity and for the shared goals of the team. Kurt spent 16 years as president and CEO of SRI International in Silicon Valley, building teams of champions within a 2,500-person R&D and innovation company. During his tenure at SRI, its revenue more than tripled, and SRI became a global model for the systematic creation of high-value innovations, such as HDTV, Siri on the iPhone 4, and many other world-changing advances. These innovations created tens of billions of dollars in new economic value. Mayfield Ventures partner David Ladd said, SRI is the leading company in the world at converting its technology into commercial value. Today, Kurt Carlson leads Practice of Innovation, a group with the vision that the world's innovative potential can be profoundly improved. This would create more meaningful jobs and greater economic prosperity, environmental sustainability, social services, and security. He favors an innovation system, the discipline and practice of innovation, to help entrepreneurs and their companies to better succeed through innovation in our opportunity-rich but demanding world. He openly shared his value creation methodology with us in episode number 37. We'll link to that again in our podcast page. Today, he's going to share with us how to build teams of champions. We're honored to have Kurt with us again as a guest on Economics for Entrepreneurs. Let's listen carefully and take as much value as we can from this world leader. Kurt, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Great to be with you, Hunter, as always.
Well, you're very famous with our listeners because you shared your proven NABC model of innovation. It's the model that works. It's been utilized by innovation teams worldwide to create billions of dollars in market revenues. Let's call that the how of innovation. But you also have deep insights to share on the who of innovation, the kinds of the kinds of people that are needed for success in the innovation process. So, give me a little bit of background about that, Kurt, and then we'll go through your 9 points of innovation champions.
Oh, beautiful, wonderful. Well, so the first thing, Hunter, is all innovations these days are interdisciplinary, and each one of those disciplines brings its own language. And so it's kind of a Tower of Babel when you first get together. So one of the first things you need to do in an enterprise is develop a common language so people can communicate effectively. And I would argue the common language we all should share is that focused on the customer, because that's where we're going. We're going to try and deliver new value to the customer. So you just mentioned one of the most important for us, which is the definition of a value proposition. Just four questions. What's the need? What's the approach for the offering and the business model? What are the benefits per cost? And what's the competition? So that's just one example. And we had a number of things like that. And as you just said, the common language is not just about the how do we do this? It's also about the people. It's about the other parts of the innovative process. So the thing we decided to talk about today is the people. What kind of people, and how do you talk to them, and how do you get them to understand what's required? And people use lots of words for that, but we're going to talk about the word champion. So if it's okay, I'd like to give you a very short value proposition, because again, at SRI, everything started with a value proposition. So I'm going to try and do one off the cuff here for why we picked that word. So innovation is actually a really demanding activity. It can take a long time. Most of the things we did at SRI, like high definition television, intuitive surgical, took over 15 years, 10 to 15 years. And you need a way to talk to people about the kind of commitment and energy and enthusiasm you need to be able to do that. And you want, in a company, you want, or an enterprise, you want to have a language that applies to everybody. You can't have a specialized language for Hunter and one for Kurt. That kind of divides us. You know, you're a certain type and I'm a certain type, and that's not good. So you'd like to have a common language that encapsulates the ideas that motivate people and capture the spirit of what's required. So the word we settled on after trying everything of we could imagine, the approach, was the word champion. We asked everybody at SRI to be a champion for their initiative or whatever they were doing and whatever, you know, level or whatever. Everybody was asked to be a champion, including me. I was the champion for our value creation process, and I was happy always to tell people that as an example of what it meant to be a champion. And we'll come back to the ingredients of that. I want to save that for the second part. What are the benefits per cost of that? Well, you have to communicate what that means. So there is a cost when you pick a word that's a little different than most, but it's not too much. You just keep on using it, and eventually people understand what it is. But the plus side of that is enormous, because first off, everybody knows what champions are. Everybody has an image of a champion who shares a vision, is passionate about it, has a commitment, is willing to work hard. A great teamwork, of course, it comes with all these concepts that are built in that you don't have to explain, that everybody understands. And it's a word, again, that can apply to everybody. So, Hunter, are you a champion for these podcasts?
I am. I'm a champion for our economics for business process.
You are. And you're a champion, I know, for a bunch of other things, too. And given the that I know you, and given the passion you bring, it's kind of, I don't have to really ask you that. I can tell that almost immediately, but we're going to talk about that. So, and it applies to everyone. So that's part of why it's so effective. We're not excluding anybody. We're including people into this sense of achievement and passion and commitment and hard work. So what are the alternatives to it? Well, there are a lot. So when I got this, one senior vice president was calling people heroes. And I thought, ooh, that's kind of a dangerous word. Hunter, if you're a hero, what am I? You know, am I mashed potatoes? I don't know. It makes me feel bad, right? And again, you know, you don't want people to feel like they have to be a hero to get their job done. You want them to feel like they're being supported and productive and working together in teams. And a hero is kind of an isolating word. It's not a group word like champion. We're all together. So we thought that was a bad idea. There are other words that people often use. One is entrepreneur or intrapreneur in companies. I never said those words at SRI, even though our company's in the middle of Silicon Valley, you might think that's the word I would pick. Well, here in Silicon Valley, that's kind of a dangerous word. You know, some of the characters who are running around aren't exactly the best teammates and role models. For the kind of things we're doing.
Renegades and rebels, I think you call them.
So it comes with some baggage. You know, it's got some good, obviously, some great qualities, right? There are people who put the ingredients of a new venture together and raise the funds and do all those kind of great things. But in a company like a normal company, like SRI, there are very few entrepreneurs. And we only had one entrepreneur probably every 3 to 5 years, and we had 2,500 people. They're very rare. It's scale. You know, there's a mom and pop kind of entrepreneur. But that's that we weren't doing that. We were trying to create billion-dollar businesses. So that's kind of a different scope. But all of the people at SRI could be value creators. They could be champions for their part of it. So again, think of Siri. Siri took us about 15 years, and we were doing value creation that whole time. And we had people who were passionate about the research they were doing and adding value, and calling them entrepreneurs at the beginning of that would have been a big mistake. It would have given people the wrong idea. They'd be thinking about spinning out too soon. What we learned is you don't want to spin out too soon because that's a path to failure. So for all these reasons, we picked the word champion. It solved the problem, the need of communicating effectively. The approach is a simple word that everybody understands. The benefits per cost are easy to communicate, but it applies to everybody, so it's inclusive. And the competition is a lot of different things, but they all come with baggage, so we decided they'd be inappropriate. So that's how we got here, and that's how we decided.
Good. That's really helpful in thinking about language, and we appreciate that. I'm going to ask you to walk us through the attributes, and then I'm going to come back to some of that language at the end. So you said a champion immediately creates the first version of the NABC value proposition. So that's a behavioral trait. But tell us why that's at the top of the list.
Yeah. And so in the list, you know, they come out in different ways depending on what you're doing. So we're just going through the list I happened to write out that day. So when people would come to me, so let's say you came to me and you're a new employee at SRI, you might come to me and say, Kurt, I've got this new initiative. Will you support it? And I probably would ask you, you know, at a high level, what is it? And if I thought it had promise, I'd probably ask you, will you be the champion for it? And so these are the questions we're about to discuss. And we had a rule at SRI, which is no champion, no project, no exception. So my casual asking you whether you're a champion is not so casual in a way. It's a sense of commitment, and are we serious about it? Now, I forgot this is one of the benefits of this, which is after a while, all the staff knew that I wasn't asking them to do this just because it was Kurt being cute. It's because they all really understood that it's a very competitive world. And they really did understand that if somebody doesn't say yes, they're going to be passionate about it. We're just kidding ourselves. And that happens, as you know, better than anybody in a lot of companies. So that would be kind of the setting for how we might start this discussion. So I would then say, well, you know, the way we start around here is we write down your value proposition on a piece of paper, just four questions, N, A, B, C. You can use four pages or one page, but no more than that. Write it down. And if I thought the person was impatient and, you know, they often think that management's too sluggish and slow, I might ask him to come the next morning. I mean, I did that. Often I'd say, if I saw somebody who was really kind of excited and disappointed that people weren't paying attention to him, I'd say, okay, write down these four questions and come see me tomorrow at 7 a.m. That's my first appointment. No hesitation. We're going to get going. And so I'm trying to role model right from the beginning the behaviors we want from our champions, right? So that's part of my job as the CEO of the company is I got to role model these things as well. And they would come back and they'd all be terrible, of course, because every person I proposition is terrible. This is an aside, but Hunter, we've done this now with 500 teams from some of the leading companies in the world. People, you know, these are PhDs from Harvard and MIT and Caltech and Berkeley, and they're in these big companies. And they've been working on this stuff for years, and we're doing a workshop, and we say, we want you to answer these four questions. These are, we'd have a discussion. First off, you agree these are fundamental questions you ought to be able to answer. And And they think it's kind of silly in the beginning because they're convinced they can answer them. So we say, oh, well, yeah, good. So take 20 minutes, write down on one piece of paper the answer to these four questions. 500 teams. Not one team has been able to convincingly answer those questions the first time. Not one. Not one.
We are learning how teams made up of champions build new revenue streams by a customer-focused innovation. You can become a champion innovator with the help of our online course, The Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey. It helps you to deploy many of the techniques we're discussing today and we discussed in episode 37, including the translation of a well-articulated value proposition into an effective brand platform. Check it out at e4epod.com/journey. That's the letter E, the number four, the letter E, pod.com/journey. And now back to our conversation with Kurt.
And you know, the part of that that is most surprising to me is getting the need inexact or wrong. Just, I know it's a diversion, but why is that? Why can't we get the need right?
Well, we all fall in love with our idea. That's the biggest problem, right? Typically when this new person would come to me, they'd say, Kurt, the need is obvious. This is brilliant. No one's done this before. I want 3 hours to talk about my approach. The benefits are just compelling, just absolutely compelling. And there's no competition. That's what a typical first presentation sounds like. Now you think when you go into a big company, like a top 10 company, it would be different than that, right? No. It's not. They're still in love with their ideas. So this is a basic, the whole field of, that you know about with reframing is about how do you take someone's first statement and help them really drill down to what it is. And the rule of reframing is people almost never understand the problem they're trying to solve the first time. I mean, that's been our finding. It's essentially zero. It's not that they're wrong. I mean, this is an important point, actually. It's not that they're wrong. It's just at 20,000 feet or 100,000 feet. And you've got to slowly keep on reframing it and reframing it and reframing it and help them bring it down to ground level. So they're now, you know, they're standing on the ground as opposed to in the cloud someplace. And so that's a process. It's, I mean, these are smart people. They can do that, but it helps to have a buddy to do that. So that's basically how you get started.
And then you say, having that one champion is not necessarily enough. You've got to have at least one complementary partner to share that vision.
Yeah, you need an iteration buddy. That's one of our rules. You need an iteration buddy. So, Hunter, you've done a lot of important things in your life. Is it help to have a partner?
Well, I agree with you. It's crucial. One of the things that we always look for in venture capital is a team. A team can be two people, but one founder is never going to be the one who carries the whole company to market. So we always look for a team. We look for them to be complementary, as you say. One's technical and one's marketing, maybe, but always complementary.
Right. Yeah. So often a perfect team is a technical person, a business development person, an operations person, and someone who can actually implement stuff, right? So we could do the implementation and the operations stuff at SRI. So we needed at least the technical genius, you know, someone really, who's got a key insight into the solution, and a marketing person who has key insights into the need and was willing to do the sales and the promotion, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So there's some other really important reasons, though, for having a partner. I mean, again, you've done lots of really great things. There are days when it is just awful because you can't think of a thing to do. You've just gotten turned down for the 15th time by an investor or a customer, and you're thinking, what am I going to do? And of course, what you do if you have a great partner is you call them up and say, let's go have a beer and let's talk this out. And then you reframe the situation, you learn from it, and you get your energy back, and then you go at it again. That emotional energy is really critical. The other thing is, again, this reframing problem. It's really hard for you to reframe by yourself. So what we ask people to do is, if we were doing a project together, I'd give you the value proposition, and you give it to me. And then I give it back to you, and you'd give it to me. When I did high-definition television, oh my gosh, my partner and I, when we did that, by the way, it wasn't obvious you could do this, because where do you get the bandwidth from, and how do you compress the signal? Nobody knew how to do that. So we had to come up with plausible hypotheses for doing those two things. And we had to make them believable. And my partner and I, literally for months, we rehearsed the simple NABC value proposition back and forth, back and forth. What's the objection to this? What's the argument for this? Can we do it better? How do we prove this? We just went back and forth, and we'd give it to each other. That's what we did. It was just, you know, playing a game of check, of a catch, basically. I'd throw it to him, he'd throw it back to me, and we'd give each other feedback. So the buddy thing is a really powerful idea.
Yeah. And then you say you build the team over time, or at least your two buddies build that team over time.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, as you develop, so if you assume when you start, you know basically nothing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've done hundreds of things, and basically when I look back, I think, gosh, when we started, the problem is when you start, you actually think you know things, but they're wrong. So sometimes you end up, you start in a ditch that you have to get yourself out of before you can start going forward. So our mental model was basically, when we start, we know nothing. So again, that's why we focus on those four fundamental questions, the NABC, because that's just kind of a scaffolding for the most simple summary. And if you get that right, and you start heading in the right direction, as you know, innovation, value creation is an emergence activity. The solutions emerge. It's a complex thing. It's not a complicated thing. It's a complex thing. So you try and get the fundamentals right, and then you hope you're going in the right direction. That's what you're trying to do in the beginning. So you start with nothing. You try and answer these four questions. You start going in hopefully a positive direction. And one of our rules was to work on important things, because the number of places you can land ultimately, you know, 3, 4, 10 years later with important problems is very high. But if it's a small thing, it usually doesn't matter. Anyway. But over time, as you start putting your value proposition together, you identify other skills you need. So what do we need here? You know, we need someone who understands, in the case of Siri, natural language processing. We can solve the big problem, which is the semantic network part of it, but we don't know enough about natural language. So we got to bring someone into the team that does that. And the team builds organically that way as you identify the pieces that you need and that are missing. Another big mistake that a lot of companies make is they say, oh, you know, we're going to build a personal computer personal assistant. We'll put 30 people on it. But the problem is they don't know who to put on it at that point. So then they end up with a team that's full of conflicts and people competing with each other, and they can't stop it if it doesn't make sense, because, you know, then all these people are disappointed and they're angry at management. It's just crazy. You only start adding people as you figure out what to do.
And then you say that there's learning of skills as well, not just adding them to the team, but you're learning all the time as you go along.
Yeah. Well, so this might be a surprising thing too, but we were hiring PhDs from the best schools in America, you know, Stanford, Berkeley, CMU, you name it. I mean, straight A PhDs. No one came to us knowing how to create value. It's not taught. So you know, new people who come to SRI, they didn't know. I mean, what do we do? How do we figure out these issues? You know, what is value creation? So if you came to SRI and you were a new employee hunter, the first thing we would do is put you through our workshop to begin teaching you these things. And we would, so if this was a new employee and they hadn't been through that yet, I would say one of your jobs is the champion. You've got to learn your job, basically. You've got to go, and we're going to help you. I mean, it's not like you're on your own. We're going to help you. I mean, the first way we're going to help you is we want you to take your idea and go into one of our value creation workshops. Typically, it was 2 or 3 days, and work with your buddy on your value proposition while you learn these different concepts that you need to know. What the value proposition actually means, what are key insights into the solution, how do you identify the beachhead market and the white space and all the different things? You know, it's not This is not quantum mechanics, but as you know, you need to, again, develop that language and that concept set. So we would ask them to go do that. And that was part of the advantage of coming to SRI.
And then your next point is, it's part of that, which is iterating insistently with your teammates in those workshops, right? Yeah. Insistent iteration.
Yeah, iteration. My brother says my middle name is iteration, which probably is true. So again, you know, when you think, when you start, if you have the mental framework, you don't know anything, what you want to do is write down what you can on your value proposition, write down anything, you know, that you can gather by, you know, on the web and talking to people, and write it down with the NABC framework, and then you start talking to smart people. So Hunter, I try and talk to you every chance I get and send emails, because you're a super smart guy and you understand stuff I don't understand. So you can tell me things I would never be able to figure out on my own. I mean, I could, like, maybe I could, but it might take me, you know, 3 years. I don't know, you know. So the idea is, you know, run around, talk to smart people, talk to partners, and put your value proposition in front of them. You know, you have to protect the IP and all that kind of stuff, of course. But nevertheless, this sense of continuous iterations. Now, we augmented that at SRI with the concept called value creation forums. So every 2 to 4 weeks, we all would go to a session, typically over lunch, with pizza and Coke, where you'd stand up and you give your value proposition. And we'd give you 3 to 5 minutes to do that. And ABC, there'd be other parts of that, but not much more. And there might be 4 or 5 or 6 teams in that meeting, and they give it very quickly. And they'd have to be quiet after they gave the presentation so that they'd listen. If people argue, the meeting takes too long, and they don't listen. And remember, in the beginning, they don't know anything, so it's not worth arguing. So that's a big mistake. And then we would ask a facilitator to ask people randomly, what was good? Don't forget it. How could it be improved? Only improvement. Eyes of the customer, eyes of the investor. And then anybody else who wanted to chime in. So these different, again, we're reframing continuously with different perspectives from different people. And the magic of those meetings was not actually apparent to me in the beginning when we invented it. The magic of it is that because everybody's using these concise frameworks, NABC, when you see 4 or 5 of them in a row, so NABC and, you know, need, approach, benefits, per cost, competition, and then the second person does it, and then the third person, the fourth person, they start out, again, very incoherent. They're not quantitative. They're not compelling. But always, because these are smart, committed people, somebody will do a good job. Someone will actually really identify the customer need and not do it at 20,000 feet. They'll bring it down to the particular customer and what their specific problem is. And everybody's sitting there and they'll go, oh, that's what it looks like. Oh, and then somebody else will be very specific about the competition. And then everybody goes, oh, that's what it looks like. And then someone will be able to identify the different benefits per cost, the value. And it's not just the quantitative stuff like the price. It's all the other stuff. It's emotional content. It's experiences. It's all those things that come into that, which are not so easy to identify and to articulate. So over time, people, by watching these, are doing what we call comparative learning. They're comparing one against the other. Hunter, when you buy a car, do you compare different cars?
Actually, not often. I've become committed to a brand and a model, and I'm stuck in my ways now.
Okay, well, I wish I didn't ask you that. I'm sorry, I see that one. What I should have done is said, Hunter, do you sometimes choose different lunches? Do you compare your lunches?
I certainly do. You look for something different every day.
There you go. Thanks for that answer. Well, most of us do that. Most of us compare different things. You know, we're in a town. What kind of restaurant are we going to go to? Well, we go here, there, there. Most of us compare our cars, different makes, what have you. Comparative, and all of science is that way. That's what we do. We compare different results. That's the whole scientific method is basically doing that continuously to see if we can prove our case, our working hypothesis. So we didn't realize the power of comparative analysis when we started basically inventing this way of doing incubation. And it turns out to be gangbusters. It really is an exponential learning process. You build on each other in a compounding way that is not done with complicated methodologies or when people get individually coached. Individual coaching works, but it's very slow and it doesn't tap into this really powerful mechanism of comparing. So we would say to the champion, one of your jobs is to come every 2 to 4 weeks and present and get this feedback.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's MISES.org/E4EPod and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Is there some competition in that, Kurt, as well as comparison? I want to be best. I want to be the guy that they say, whoa, he's really got it.
Well, so you don't want to put people doing the same thing in the room, so because that would really be destructive. So you don't do that. So typically these are 4 or 5 teams that are doing very different kinds of things. So they're not directly competing with each other. That would be a terrible thing. The other thing is we keep these meetings unrelentingly positive. I mean, we just do not allow negative comments. It's all about we're in this together. We're all struggling to get the knowledge we need and make the improvements we need, and we're all going to help each other. And the feedback you're going to get from Hunter and others is a gift. And so, I would say it's not competitive that way, but it is slightly competitive because people do want to succeed. And when somebody does a good job, that does raise the bar. And everybody, because again, these are people who've always gotten straight A's in everything they ever did. They want to come in the next time and be better than that. So I would call it friendly competition. It's not the kind of competition that you see in most companies, not at all.
So in another list or item on your list, which is slightly different than the ones we've talked about so far, is this champion has enviable human values. So tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, that is a little different. I think there's a lot of confusion about that when people think about business. So, Hunter, would you work with me if I didn't treat you with respect?
Probably not, but I'd certainly try and find out why that was the case and see if I could adjust that.
Yeah, you would. I mean, given who you are, if something seems like it's disconnected, the right thing to do is to try and fix it, right? That's the first thing. But if someone is fundamentally disrespectful of other people, nobody wants to work with them. And again, I mentioned things like high definition television, intuitive surgical. These things took over 10 years. And you know, if you didn't have respectful relationships, people aren't going to work intensely together and work as hard as they need to. And as you know, whenever you're doing something like that, crises happen all the time. You know, you need to be able to call up your buddy and say, I need you. For example, I had a customer once who called me up at 6 o'clock in the morning and said, Kurt, I need you in Alaska tonight, and I'm in Princeton. Well, we were real partners, right? So I'm not going to say no to him. But if he was treating me badly, you know, with disrespect, and wasn't including me and not helping empower me, the answer might have been no, right? So we actually believe that human values, when you're doing things that really matter and you're working intensely this way, which gives you a lot of satisfaction, the human values are really even more important because this is a very human activity. And you can't force people to do these things. These basically people who sign up for this, doing these kind of things, are volunteers, right? You can't force them to do this. So human values to us were really fundamental. I'll give you one specific example. So I would give, we had new employees. I did the first value creation workshop for all new employees, from the janitors to the CEOs of our companies. And I'd have somebody demonstrate NABC value propositions, and the group would give feedback. And by the way, everybody can give valuable feedback, from the janitors to the CEOs. It doesn't matter. They all see different things, but it can be all helpful. So I wanted to demonstrate this concept that is important to us, and also how important feedback is in terms of improvement, and that we all had to be open to that. By the way, that was include me, right? Because I was going to these forums, and my presentations were all terrible when we started, and everybody saw that. And here, you know, a brand new employee sometimes would come in, and I'd ask them, you know, what do you think about this? And they're going, you mean I can tell the CEO that this is completely wrong? Yeah, of course. Because otherwise, you know, I had to go visit other CEOs all the time. And what would I rather do? You know, be in a friendly environment and get information, or go to see that person, and the person would probably never want to see me again. So, but just on this values, the human values part. One of the things I really emphasize that we made a big deal of in SRI is respect for others. That was really a fundamental thing. And, you know, this is a big issue right now with all of the issues we're talking about, you know, diversity and inclusion and those sorts of things. And I would tell you, when I would make that part of it, and we'd have a discussion about that, the Black people in the room were always nodding their heads up and down. Respect for others, and they're nodding their heads. And I want to tell you, if that doesn't get to you, you know, you're not paying attention. They're telling you something really, really important, right?
Mm-hmm.
So respect for others. And we made a big deal about that, because without that, doing the kind of things we did at SRI is not possible.
Then the next item I'm looking at in your list, Kurt, is organizationally responsible.
Yeah. Now, that's a good start on why I didn't use the word entrepreneur. So entrepreneurs think of themselves as renegades. Their job is to basically blow up the organizations. So again, if you think about innovation as being a long game, it takes, you know, year after year of really hard work working together. People who are out, you know, sabotaging the organization or doing things that are disruptive, it doesn't work. You can't get there when people are behaving that way. I would tell you, though, frankly, that was not with the kind of people we attracted, with the kind of values we're talking about. That was a problem when I first got there, because we've discussed before, as you know, the place had been failing for 20 years and it was bankrupt, basically, and the buildings were falling down and everybody hated each other. But after we got going and we started achieving, it just disappeared as a problem. If you treat people with respect and you give them an opportunity to do great things, it's amazing how many problems that solves.
And they take responsibility. That was the other point we were emphasizing.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing about being a champion, right? You're responsible. The next couple are you persevere, you don't make excuses. You know, it's going to be a long journey. It's going to be hard. I should emphasize, we're going to help you. I mean, it's not like we're just telling them they're off on their own. These value creation forums meant they got to show up regularly. I was often at them. I would go around the enterprise and, you know, go to different ones all the time. And we're always looking for opportunities for people who were either stuck or had potential and were not getting paid enough attention. So we were trying to support them every way we could. I can tell you some wonderful stories about that. Maybe, but the goal was to succeed. And you know, if you sign up for this, then you know that's what we want to do. We want to do important things, and we're committed to giving you the skills to help you do that. And if you want that, we think this is one of the only places in the world you ought to be.
So going back to your opening point about language, you and I have been involved in a discussion recently about leadership. You have not used the word leadership or leader in this entire discussion. And so explain the difference between being a champion and being a leader.
Oh, boy. Well, so again, what you want to be is inclusive. And I think that's missed a lot. So Hunter, if you're the leader, am I the follower?
Well, I understand that dichotomy. I agree with you. I think that's, my mind goes straight to that. If there's leadership, there must be followership, and that doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah. Now, suppose you know, you don't know me. Let's say you're a new employee, and the first time you see me, I show up in a meeting, and I go, well, I'm the leader here. What do you think of me at that point?
Well, it's a little bit arrogant to set yourself above the others. That would be my personal impression.
It sure is. So again, when you think about respect for others, you wouldn't do that, right? So it, again, we go back to these fundamental things that our mothers taught us, very kind of basic stuff. So, but we can both be champions for what we do and take different roles. So if I'm the BD guy, I guess you'd normally, in one of our projects starting out, you might normally think I'm kind of the leader for that activity. But I will tell you, I never felt that way. Everything I ever did, I had a technical, so I did a lot of business development, as you can imagine, as the CEO of a company like that. And so I always felt actually like I was working for the technical staff, and I knew that I had nothing without them. I couldn't do a thing. So I thought of it as a partnership. Partnership, again, is one of those other words that's inclusive. So, you know, you do, Hunter, your things, you do things that are better than I can do, and I do some things better than you do. And we take turns, and we've worked that out. But if I went around saying that I'm the leader of this project, and you're on my team, you're probably going to be put off by that. And by the way, there's no need to say that word. So I never, there are a lot of words I never said. I barely ever mentioned management. Now, this sounds kind of crazy because every project has management. But again, we kind of reframed that. So no entrepreneurship, no entrepreneurs. Nope, that's no good. I never used the word management. Sorry, not management. We use that more often. Yeah, leadership. And we tried to focus always on the work and the objective of doing important things and satisfying our customers. That was the unifying theme of everything. And if you focus that way, it solves so many problems, important problems, focus on the customer, making a contribution. Everybody, so here's a little thing about teams. So we taught our people all this stuff, right? So many people put together teams that are not well formed, primarily in the beginning because they haven't done their homework on the value proposition, so they don't know who to put in the team. But the other is they often put in people who have the same kind of skills. So, you know, we're going to build a computer assistant. Okay, we need 5 AI people. Well, no, you don't. You need 5 people who can solve 5 different problems. And if you put people who have the same skill into a team, they're going to compete with each other and they're going to fight with each other. So our rule was they have to share the vision, they have to have unique complementary skills, and they have to feel like they're sharing in the rewards. Those 3 things: shared vision, complementary skills, shared rewards. So we learned that, you know, if we do that, then people will collaborate really intensely. And if we violate that, again, something we see in every company we go into, it's like, why is that person on that team? Doesn't belong here.
Yeah. Well, Kurt, we've learned a lot today. You speak our language, but you speak it better than we do. We certainly are customer focused, and we certainly try to focus on the problem to be solved. The intro to this podcast talks about economic heroes, and I'm going to change that immediately to economic champions, because you've laid out such a great understanding of how to get to the end point, the goal of satisfying the customer with innovation. So we've learned a lot.
Hunter, I would tell you that, you know, I worked for a big company for my RCA and then GE, and they didn't teach us any of these things. And when we became part of SRI, we started on a program of learning. And that was the key insight we had, is learn, learn, learn. And we would have our meetings every 2 weeks where everybody would stand up and share something they learned. And bit by bit, we discovered that the words that we're talking about here, some of them caused problems, some of them didn't help, and others really did help. And it was really kind of an empirical study over time. And here's the thing I would tell our audience today. These may seem like small things to some. You know, okay, entrepreneur is pretty good. Champion, maybe it's a little bit better, but it's probably 10%. It's not 10%. It's 100%. It's a big deal. Including people and getting them to work collaboratively is not a little thing. That is the biggest thing you can do to get to solve big, important problems. If you can do that, it looks like magic from the outside, but it's not. It may look like magic, but it's not luck. It's a consequence of doing the right things.
Right. Good. Well, Kurt, we better wrap it up there for time, but thank you very much. And also, if I may, I'll link to your very recent article in Harvard Business Review, which focuses on some of these things, but also talks a lot about active learning. And perhaps next time we have you back, we don't have time today, but we can talk about active learning together.
Ooh, that would be fun. That's my other, you know, that's my, so you know, the things that I've learned since I left SRI, one was, that Harvard Business Review article I wrote, it was funny, a young lady who's an entrepreneur sent me a wonderful note. And I said, why do you like it? And she sent me back an amazing write-up, an amazing thing. So I called her up and I talked to her. And she's a multiple-time entrepreneur, a real entrepreneur. She does Bitcoin for bank security. And she's a coach at a venture incubator for the university she's at. Really nice, smart lady. And she actually got what I was trying to do. She said, you're trying to create a new discipline that's the convergence of business, value creation, active learning, the best way to learn, and behavioral science. I said, bingo, that's it. So that's another interesting topic.
Let's do that next time, Kurt. So thank you very much for today. And we will talk to you next time.
Okay, great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Bye-bye.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.